Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. In the 19th and 20th centuries, tens of thousands of Indigenous children were sent to boarding schools in the U.S. and Canada, also known as residential schools. They were government-funded and typically run by churches. The schools were designed to strip children of their Indigenous language, culture, and community, and to assimilate them into white, Christian, Eurocentric society. Investigations by both the Canadian and American governments have found that thousands of children died at these institutions. The investigations also note widespread physical and sexual abuse that created lasting trauma for survivors and their descendants. Today is the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, also known as Orange Shirt Day. It's a day to explain and revisit the tragedies that took place in the residential school system, and to honor what these children went through and acknowledge the effect that it had on their descendants. Descendants like Beverly Little Thunder. She's a Huntington resident and Lakota elder who belongs to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in North Dakota. Several generations of her family have firsthand experience with these boarding schools. Beverly and her daughter, Lushanya Echeverria, recently attended a film screening in Burlington for a documentary about the residential school system. It's called Sugarcane. Vermont Public reporter Elodie Reed went with them. A warning that the story we're about to play covers sensitive material, including sexual abuse. Here's Elodie.
In the car on the way to the theater, Beverly shares what she knows about her mom's and aunt's time in boarding school.
One time she and my mom were talking and I was sort of eavesdropping. I was doing something in the room. And my Aunt Gloria said, "You know, Christina," she says, "remember the time they put us each in a closet and locked the door and left us there overnight?" And she's, "because we were playing with our dolls and we were talking in Lakota." And my mom said, "yeah." My aunt said, "we were just 4 years old." She says, what makes someone do that to a baby?" She said, "we were so babies." And she started crying and my mom started crying. I really don't know, you know, the extent of how it affected her. I know that she, you know, she was not real physically affectionate, but then how could she be? I'm sure she was modeling after, you know, the people that she was around when she was growing up.
Which school did your mom go to?
She went to Flandreau.
Flandreau Indian School in South Dakota is on the United States list of federal Indian boarding schools. It still operates as a federally run off-reservation boarding school for Indigenous students, one of the few left in the country.
And Beverly, did you attend a boarding school?
I was in boarding school for about 6 months, and then I was sent to another boarding school for about 6 months. And then I went to another boarding school and I was sent up to a school called Intermountain up in Utah.
Intermountain Indian School is also on the list of federal Indian boarding schools. It operated from 1950 to 1984.
They were mean. That's all I can say is they were mean. You know, I don't think anyone ever spoke with a kind word or a gentle way. They would pull our hair. It was past the time when they would cut your hair and past the time when, you know, you would get in trouble if you spoke your language. But by then, most of the kids that were there didn't speak their language. There was also a lot of Christian doctrine that, you know, was spilled on us, and it was like, I don't like this. So, and I was old enough where I felt like I could make it on my own, so I ran away.
How old were you?
I was probably about 13.
13?
Yeah.
As we drive toward the theater, I ask Beverly how she's feeling about going to see a documentary that inevitably will reflect some of these experiences.
It was something that I wanted to see. I know that it'll probably evoke some emotions, but I think that film and its content should evoke emotions. And it can be a reminder of the work that still needs to be done.
We arrive in Burlington just as the sun casts a deep golden hue over Lake Champlain. Beverly's daughter, Lushanya, turns around from the front seat to look at her mom, who's in the back with me.
What?
We're going to let you off here.
Okay.
We're just going to go park.
Okay.
We all walk into the Main Street Landing building.
While we're walking, Lushanya, can you tell me why you're here as well?
Yeah, this story is very interesting to me because the matriarchs in my family were raised with the boarding school mentality, mindset, and practices. But also, as an educator, I worked with many Native American families whose families, their participation in boarding schools impacted their current modern day students' attendance at school and trust in schools. So I worked with a lot of families around boarding school, trauma healing and stuff.
Inside, Beverly and Lushanya get some popcorn.
Do you want to taste it to make sure it's...
not like salt.
Then we all find our seats in a sold-out theater.
I'm just looking around trying to see if there's other Native people here, and I don't see any yet.
We've overheard some people saying that because of the title, they thought it was about sugarcane, and they're very surprised about what the topic is. That's always great.
Just before the lights go down, Lushanya leans towards Beverly to make sure she has some tissues. And then...
All right. You're going to start in just a couple of minutes. I'm going to turn this off.
I felt dirty as an Indian all my life in residential school.
The nearly two-hour film braids together three stories stemming from the British Columbia-based Williams Lake First Nation. The reserve is known as Sugar Cane, and the residential school there was St. Joseph's Mission. It follows an investigation into the atrocities that took place at the Catholic-run school.
For decades, there were reports of neglect, children dying or disappearing from this facility.
It bears witness to survivors voicing their stories, including filmmaker Julian Bravenoisecat's father.
You do know what happened with me, right?
I want to know the whole story.
And it documents another survivor as he seeks accountability from the Catholic Church.
Being sorry for something is just the first step. You have to take action.
The film holds these stories and surrounds them with scenes of natural beauty, affection between family, vibrant culture, and solemn spirituality. Behind it all is a resonant score composed by Odinak First Nation musician Molly Obomsawin. At the end of the documentary, statistics flash across the screen to remind the viewer that, while this is the story of one community, these schools, designed for Indigenous cultural erasure, were built across Canada, across the United States. In fact, one school on the list was in Vermont. While different in scale to the residential schools that operated for decades, assimilating thousands of Indigenous youth, a Baptist missionary did send two Potawatomi teenage boys to the medical school in Castleton in the late 1820s. That's according to reporting by the Burlington Free Press. The Free Press also found out that those two boys died from tuberculosis within a few years, and that, quote, both were stripped of their Native identities by the times of their deaths, end quote. As the theater lights come back up and audience members begin to chatter, Beverly and Lushanya stay silent, except for blowing their noses. We continue in silence out of the theater and into the building lobby. there, Beverly takes a seat and she begins to speak.
It was hard. And I think about all the people I know my age. You know, that suffered through their parents and their parents' dysfunction. And probably some of them didn't even understand why. And they kept talking about healing. They kept using that word heal. And I wondered. I thought I knew what it meant, but I don't think I know what it means. Because, you know, how do you heal from something like that?
Beverly notes the moment in the film when a residential school survivor goes to the Vatican to ask for some kind of response to the well-documented sexual abuse of indigenous children perpetuated by the Catholic Church. During the summer of 2022, Pope Francis traveled to Canada to give a formal apology for the church's role in the residential school system. And for Beverly, this brings up a personal experience she had as a child in a church-run orphanage, where she lived in addition to federally run boarding schools.
And I was sexually abused by a nun. But I know what it's like not to talk about it. It wasn't nice that the Pope said he was sorry. It's so easy to say I'm sorry after the damage is done. There's so much going through my mind right now.
One of those things running through Beverly's mind is the response of the people in the theater around her to what they just witnessed.
Even listening to them clap, seeing it as, you know, an art form, a film, how done it, well done it was, and how it was produced. And I just wondered how many people that were sitting around me and that saw it. Really understood. I heard two ladies talking about their geraniums.
I noticed you both holding hands a number of times. But really, how did it feel to have Lushanya next to you?
I was glad she was there.
You want me to kick their asses? The geraniums.
No, go find out what variety they were.
That story was produced by Vermont Public reporter Elodie Reed. Joining us now in the studio is Lushanya Echevarria. She is an educator, a storyteller, and the executive director of a 100-acre spiritual learning center in Huntington that is dedicated to sharing Lakota teachings and ceremonies. Lushanya, welcome.
Thank you so much.
We're really glad to have you. And listeners, we are glad to have you today as well. You can join the conversation. Do you recognize Orange Shirt Day at home or in the classroom? Give us a call. Our number is 800-639-2211. You can also send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Now, Lushanya, you were sitting out in our green room with your mother and both of your partners listening to that conversation and that story, which was a very difficult and very personal one. What was it like hearing it again with your mother there?
Listening to the shift from her while we were driving to the theater and hearing her tell her story and telling her experiences from a more objective place, from her lived experience, and then the shift to after the movie and the emotion in her voice, and also recalling what it felt like at the end of the movie and being very emotional and also looking at the audience and hearing the audience's response to the movie.
Do you remember the first time you heard some of your family's history? Was it your mother who shared that with you?
My mother always talked about her experience at the boarding school. One of the first times that I paid attention and to her experience and how it influenced her life was not too long ago. It was probably about 15 years ago. And I went through an adult education program. And part of the program was learning how to be in camaraderie, learning how to acknowledge and community and recognizing that every person in a community is important. And the group that exhibited that the most in that program were veterans. And I remember putting together that the mindset of those veterans and how concerned they were about every person that was part of the community felt very familiar to what I was raised with in our community, in our family community, in our spiritual community. And I asked my mother, where did you learn how to be so concerned about every person in your community and how to make sure that every person felt included? And she said, from boarding school. Because in boarding school, we had to watch out for each other. We had to always know where our classmates were because we were protecting each other, not the adults. The adults were not protecting us.
Did you hear the stories that you were told growing up? Did you hear them reflected in the movie Sugarcane, which a listener just noted is currently screening at Catamount Arts in St. Johnsbury, and there's a number of different screenings going on in this region.
That's great. Yes, watching the movie Sugarcane, seeing the different, hearing the stories from the different people that had experienced that particular school was very reflective of the work that I've been doing for 15 years in public school, in the public school system. Because so not only the stories that I heard growing up from my mother, but working with children, working with students, and noticing that our Native American student population had the highest truancy rate. They had they attended school the least. And we had to, you know, pursue that and investigate why our students were not coming to school. And as a result, we began holding talking circles for families, began trying to bring our Native American families in to become familiar, acquainted, and trusting of the school. And so in those talking circles with those hundreds of adults, they talked about their experience at school. Not only the parents of my students, but the grandparents would come in and talk about their experience. So the stories of not being there to raise your child, abandoning children, families being torn apart or broken apart. Stories of the school was responsible. You know, there's some mindset that the school is responsible for raising my child, not the parent. And of course, the abuse, the sexual abuse and the mental abuse.
Were those stories that were shared with you at an early age? I can imagine it must be difficult for someone as a young child to hear about the abuse and experiences like that a parent went through, but also perhaps a way of bonding and connecting and protection.
I think that in our family, as a child, hearing those stories, I think, can be kind of triggering as a young child. And especially if the trigger might come from like having experienced that kind of abuse as well, as we know, it gets passed down. And I think that as we get older, as we evolve as, you know, as our individual selves, as we get to know our parents as adults, as we get to see our parents as human beings and not just our parents, I think that those, sharings as children and those conversations that happen as children, I think they really do help the adult child and the adult parent create a stronger bond. Because I think that we as the children are going intergenerationally, we take on those behaviors as well. And I think understanding where those behaviors come from in our parents help us become better adults. I've always been told that our parents did just a little bit better than their parents did. And so what I can appreciate and take from those conversations that I've had with my mother and that I've heard those stories all my life is I get to do a little bit better with the generation coming. I get to do a little bit better as an adult or as a parent or an aunt.
I see that work bringing a smile to your face. Yeah. Can tell it lights you up.
Yeah, it's important. It's important for me to be a part of the intergenerational healing. I think that in our generation, we are privileged to have the tools and the resources to heal ourselves.
As we noted earlier, this National Day for Truth and Reconciliation is commemorated in both the United States and Canada. And I'd like to add one more voice to the conversation now. Jacques Watso is a band counselor and elected official with the Abenaki Council of Odonak. He lives in Odonak, Quebec, which is an Abenaki First Nations reserve just northeast of Montreal. Jacques, welcome.
Bonjour.
Thank you for joining us. Now, could you tell us a bit about your own family's connection to the residential schools that we're discussing today? You had family members who were sent away to them, is that right?
Yes. Well, the Odonak experience is one of a true legitimate experience where our family members were sent to the residential school. See, the Watso family and other families were part of the Anglican mission here in Odonak. There are two missions, one, the Anglican one, and the Catholic one. And the Catholic church would have what we call a day school here, where our actual museum is today, where the Grey Nuns had the same mission as the Anglican church to kill the Indian in the child. And my family were sent off to Chapleau in Northern Ontario, which is over 1,500 kilometers from the Odonak. They were sent by train, and they would come back just 1 month through the year. And like many other members of Odonak, they were affected by the residential school treatment here in Canada, which was institutionalized by the 600 reserves that's across Canada.
Mm. 600 reserves. How did the residential school curriculum specifically impact the use of language that children arrived at these schools with?
Well, here for the day school here, it was forbidden to speak English, and it was forbidden to speak Abenaki, and it was forbidden to speak Abenaki in the community. And the priest, which was the man that ran the community, was a missionary, and his mission was to evangelize how do we say, Christianize the Abenaki. And part of the Christianity is to forbid the spoken language of the Abenaki, because that's the devil's language. Mm. The elders here in Onak still talk about the day school there that was run by the Grey Nuns and the priests, where it was forbidden to the kids were beaten. My mother, she was the youngest. Even if she was Anglican, she went to the Catholic Church here, and since she was Abenaki and Anglican, they would get beat by the Grey Nuns because they spoke the Abenaki language and the Abenaki culture. So I had a little story. Our elected counselor, Clyde Abamsa, when she passed last year, and she used to tell stories about getting beat, and she would come back home and she was ashamed to be Abenaki because the priests, the people uptown, the French Canadian, they would all tell us that it was bad to be an Indian. It was bad. Our culture wasn't worth being lived, and our spirituality and in our language, and it was all the devil's work, and we were evil people. But when you're a child, you're very impressionable, especially when you come back home to your loving family and the rest of society tells you that you're evil. It messes with your personal growth. Mm.
Lushanya, tell us a little bit about your journey, kind of shifting from that perhaps inherited shame that Jacques is talking about, shifting from shame towards pride in your heritage.
I've always been raised with a pride in our heritage. I've always have felt that my spiritual practice and my spiritual beliefs were the most important guidance that I had. I was given that opportunity to be in ceremonies from birth until present day. I was able to speak about my beliefs and my practices, and little by little, people showed interest in that lifestyle. And I also have to say that my mother, Beverly, she just was persistent in making sure that ceremony was a part of our daily life. And when folks opposed it or criticized it, she was willing to, I always say, like, my mother was willing to die for her beliefs. And that instills a sense of importance. And seeing her commitment to keeping the traditions alive in her own life and in our family against or with the adversity is a pretty influential stand to watch your whole life.
Hmm. Jacques, did you also feel like you had to make a shift from a inherited sense of shame about your Indigenous heritage towards one of pride? Or did you, like Lushanya, grow up with that pride really instilled in you?
Well, it took self-consciousness, because most of our community were going through the same pattern where we were all shameful, and that was our collective heritage here in Odenak, whether you were Catholic, Anglican, French, or English. People, they started, and now the elders today are telling us, well, you know, we'll deal with our own traumas, and we want to break this cycle of intergenerational traumas, and we want you guys, the younger generation, to rekindle the flame of our language, our culture, our spirituality, and to live it the way it was supposed to be lived. If Creator wanted us to be French-Canadian, He would have made us French-Canadian in the first place. And they're telling us, we'll deal with our past traumas there, we'll heal ourselves, and we want you to move forward and fully live your culture and spirituality, and we'll take the backlash of intergenerational traumas where you can fully appreciate your existence. You know? So there's this, the older generation are protecting the younger generation so they can live freely their own cultures. Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful to see here in Odenak. There was a ceremony, Saturday, community ceremony on the for Truth and Reconciliation Day. And it was nice to see all the kids, not the kids, well, the young adults there taking their place within the community. And that pride that myself, we weren't allowed when I was at their age, was very heartwarming.
Mm. Oh, we're talking about Truth and Reconciliation Day, and that word reconciliation, I imagine, is a very difficult one to grapple with. What does reconciliation look like on a, you know, a government scale? Last year, Canada agreed to pay $2.8 billion Canadian, so about $2 billion US, to settle a series of lawsuits that were seeking reparations that were done for the actions done at these residential schools, abuse, neglect. Many children died at these schools. Jacques, what does that type of reconciliation feel like to you? Or is there another type of conciliatory action that you and your community would appreciate?
Well, on the Canadian side, well, in 2007, the Canadian government apologized for all the residential school system that was put forth, and they put funding for healing and counselors and for guidance for the survivors, and they help with social programs for the community all across Canada to move forward in a positive, constructive way. Because even though with the hardship of the Indian Act and the discriminatory acts within the law, the Abenaki and all First Nations in Canada, they're always participating actively in the Canadian society. So we just wanted to take our place. And we always say that the sun shines for everybody, even us Abenaki and Odenak. And it's important for the government to speak the truth and to see what happened and acknowledge what happened. And just last Saturday, over 4 years ago, was a commemoration of the death of Joyce Echaquan, which is an Atikamekw woman, which died in the hospital caused by the neglect and racism of the nurses. And here it created a big shockwave in Quebec. And First Nations wanted the government to acknowledge that there is racism. Racism exists, and systematic racism does exist here in Quebec and Canada, but we got to acknowledge it if we want to move forward, because racism is just ignorance from the superiority of another race on a minority. So we just want to move forward. We just want to live our lives and heal from our past traumas.
Jacques Watso is a band counselor with the Abenaki Council of Odenak. He lives in Odenak, Quebec. Jacques, thank you so much for joining us today. We deeply appreciate it.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
We are also joined in the studio by Lushanya Echevarria, who runs a spiritual learning center in Huntington that's dedicated to sharing Lakota teachings and ceremonies. Lushanya, how do you acknowledge Orange Shirt Day, either this year or do you have traditions that you do every year?
So this year for Orange Shirt Day, up at Kunsikea Tamakoche, we had a sweat lodge ceremony, and we had about 20 folks there. We gathered specifically to acknowledge the atrocities, and we said prayers together. We gathered in community and in recognition of what exists, that those traumas exist within our community. And also just speaking about it, Pat, historically as an educator, just, you know, talking about Orange Shirt Day, bringing in guest speakers who have experience or can also talk about it.
Lushanya, do you know the history of Orange Shirt Day? How did this day first come about?
My understanding is that it was originated in Canada, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure about the significance of the color orange, yet it was a day of remembering the lost lives and the lost cultures of so many children, and again, its impact on the current generations.
Let's take a few calls. We have Linda calling in from Brattleboro. Linda, you're on the air. Go ahead. Hi, Linda. Are you with us? Oh, we'll come back to Linda. Let's go to Lisa in Burlington. Lisa, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call today. This is such an important topic. I wanted to speak to Orange Shirt Day. I am a Canadian American. I have dual citizenship. I'm from Nova Scotia, actually in Cape Breton. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the Mi'kmaq talk about and we celebrate and pray for are all of the missing Indigenous women. They have the Red Dress campaign that was going on as well for, Indigenous women who've been abused and who are missing, and things are not being investigated everywhere. And so I just wanted to reiterate how important this is, that it's across Canada, it's across the United States. It's something that needs to be addressed. It's something that should not be swept under the rug. And, you know, I just want to make sure that all of our Native brothers and sisters know that we stand with them in solidarity.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Lisa, so much for calling in. Any thoughts, Lushanya, on that call?
I agree with Lisa. I was going to say that in thinking about the origination of Orange Shirt Day, I am sure that it was also in collaboration with the Missing Murdered Indigenous Women movement, and which is also an equally important and contemporary impact on, in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico.
Judith in Brattleboro is up next. Judith, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thanks, Michaela. I was lucky enough to be part of a retreat a number of years ago where the priest brought in a young man from First Nation Canada, and he described how his community was mixing their Christian part with their Native part. And he passed the peace pipe around and taught our teens how to do it. And it was so wonderful to hear his whole story. The previous generation had been mostly Christian oriented, and he and his next generation were very much mixing and feeling comfortable with both.
Mm. Thank you, Judith, for calling in, sharing that experience, that mixing of cultures. Lushanya, can you tell us a little bit more about how you work with young people today? What are the types of programs and teachings that you run?
So providing an opportunity for youth to see themselves represented in the environments in which they choose to be. So in their school, in school, doing workshops with educators, with other educators, sharing curriculum that emphasizes and illustrates contemporary Native traditions and contemporary Native culture. So that's some work that I've done with my colleagues, and also asking, providing an opportunity for giving Native students a space. So having a classroom or a meeting area where Native students can come together each week and just share about their week and give them an opportunity to discuss topics that only, that they might understand. And it might feel safe. It might feel safer for them to talk about their experiences with other Native students and Native teachers. One program that I worked with was called Living in Two Worlds. So in my school district, we had students who would go to the return to the reservations on the weekends or holidays or vacations, and then would attend school in the city. And there was a a dissonance for them in engaging with their city school and engaging with the city, in the city. And so I worked with the Native Connections community, and just gave students an opportunity to create collages about their world, and doing different kind of mapping to show how those worlds intersect and how they're very different. Giving children an opportunity to envision and imagine their lives and see how they could bridge their traditional life or their reservation life with some type of career or some type of work that they wanted to do to earn money.
Hmm. And where are these teachings occurring?
So I lived in Arizona. Hmm. I recently moved to Vermont permanently. But I worked in the school district in Phoenix, Arizona. Hmm. That was the Phoenix Indian High School was the hub of that community and of that school district. And for about 15, 20 years, that school district had the highest population of Native American students, because around that Phoenix Indian High School was the mental health clinic, was the medical center, was the social center for our Native populations. So that was where I had the most exposure to the families.
Yeah. Did you encounter any families who were struggling to trust the country's education system, even the public school system, schools that didn't have a direct connection to these residential or boarding schools, but were still part of, you know, the U.S. education system at large? Did you encounter that difficulty with trust after what some of these families have been through?
Sure, there was a mistrust, because the representation of BIPOC teachers to the students was very minimal. And so most parents did not find Native American educators in their school system. I can honestly say, I think that I was probably the only educator at my campus of 25 to 30 teachers. And so oftentimes finding our parents would find somebody that they felt understood them. It took a long time to build that trust. It took a very long time to build that rapport, you know, of them not feeling judged, you know, when we have to make phone calls and ask where their children are or why their children have missed so much school. Another element of missing school was because of a lot of our families still lived on the reservation, they would often attend ceremonies. And those ceremonies often would, you know, they don't go by the weekends. And so sometimes our students would miss 5 or 10 days of school. And, you know, rather than being reprimanded for that or consequenced for that, having somebody at the school who could talk to an administrator and say, this is a legitimate reason for this family missing school. How do we meet them? How do we make sure that their child still receives the education, the material that they're missing, but also honoring and respecting their need to be away?
Hmm. How has your connection to your own Indigenous identity shifted now that you live in Vermont compared to Arizona? Has there been a shift?
That's an interesting question. I've only been here about a month or two, although I did previously. Thank you. I did live here previously. And I will say that that's a great question. Because when I lived here about 15 years ago, my best friend came to visit me. We went to a play in Stowe. And when the lights came on during intermission, my best friend, who was white, looked at me and she said, I've never seen so many white people in one place. And I'm white. And I said, welcome to my world. Returning, I was just sharing with my partner the other day, I see so many BIPOC folks. I see every establishment I go into, I see somebody that has darker skin. I see somebody that I feel like I can relate to. And that so my identity as a Native person, I feel like I am more embodied in it here compared to 15 years ago. Mm. And of course, in Arizona, it was very easy because there's such a large population.
Right, right. I imagine the population's very different there. And then lastly, Lucenia, what's one big hope that you have for your work here that you're doing in Vermont and the center in Huntington?
I call my mother a national treasure. Beverly Little Thunder is a national treasure for so many, her stand for so many marginalized communities. And when she wrote her memoir, One Beat at a Time, 10, 15 years ago, her story is one of asking for help. It's one of being courageous enough to share your dreams and your visions, even in adversity. And I think that children need to know and see that courage. And so I wrote a children's book called Grandmother Turtle Land that is the children's version of asking for help and sharing your vision to help the world become a more healed place, to help the world become a more communal place among people. Wow. Every child needs to hear my mother's story, and that is my hope for our future generations.
Lucenia Echevarria, thank you so much for joining us today to help us commemorate National Truth and Reconciliation Day. We really appreciate your time here.
Thank you so much for having me and for having my family.